Well, thank you very much, Tony. It's a real pleasure to be here to open your Congress. And it's some years since I've seen Tony, but I think he was involved in the NFU some years ago, and I knew him in those days. Indeed, it was at the time when I was campaigning against our membership of the Euro. And I seem to remember that Tony was one of the ones on the NFU who was perhaps a little more sympathetic to that approach than some others. But these are, in some ways, quite challenging and quite uncertain times following the decision to leave the European Union. There is no easy way in life to take a really big decision, but we all know that sometimes you have to take big decisions, whether it's in your business or your personal life or indeed in politics. And I believe that this decision to leave the European Union is the right decision. And I think that if we now get the implementation of this right, then in 5 years' time, people will look back, perhaps wonder what all the fuss was about that we're going through now, and I hope see that it was the right decision to make. But it's also, in a department like DEFRA, quite an exciting time, an opportunity to think things through from first principles, to reconsider what our agricultural policy should look like in the future, not through the prism of what's realistic around a negotiating table with 27 other countries, but what is right for our own agriculture industry and our own farmed environment. And today, I want to set out some thoughts on the future of crop protection. And I want to start by saying that in some ways, and I've followed this debate now for 4 years, in some ways the debate's become a little bit stale, and there are quite a lot of cliches that are out there. People talk about a risk-based approach or a hazard-based approach, an evidence-based approach, the precautionary principle, and people mean different things by that. And what I've learned is that if you say you're going to have a risk-based approach, the environmental NGOs get very suspicious of you. If you say you're going to have a precautionary approach, industry gets very suspicious of you. And if you say you're going to have an evidence-based approach, well, everyone is suspicious of you. And I think what we probably need to do is to step back from some of those well-worn cliches and actually ask ourselves a more fundamental question, and that is, what should our strategy be for the future of crop protection? And I know that when it comes to individual product authorizations, there's always going to be an element of silo analysis. Of course there will. If you're looking at an individual chemical and assessing its risks, you have to do that on a case-by-case basis. But I think if we look at the wider challenge we face, as I see it, it is this. As people become more cautious and as evidence of potential risks arises, we are seeing more of our pesticides being banned. As a result of that, the confidence to invest in long-term research and development projects to bring new pesticides to the market diminishes because people are uncertain whether they will get a return on that investment in R&D. As a result, we are seeing a greater reliance on the smaller number of dwindling pesticides left in our arsenal. And as a result of that, we are encountering more problems of resistance from pests and diseases. And I think that the solution to this is probably to put at the heart of our approach integrated pest management. Now, this again is perhaps something of a cliche. It's been talked about for a long time. But I think we need to have a renewal of that concept and to put it at the heart of what we do. Because frankly, at the moment, it is something that is encouraged, it's something that is talked about, but I'm not sure we absolutely put it at the heart of what we do. And I think it means a number of things. In the context of our chemical pesticides, I think it probably means seeking to maintain a diversity of the number of chemicals that we have in order to prevent the buildup of resistance. But equally, it probably means using the chemicals that we have more judiciously, thinking carefully about the circumstances in which they could be deployed, thinking carefully about the doses that we use and the frequency with which they are used, thinking about whether their uses could be more selective. I think also we need to look more at the issue of crop husbandry. One of the things that we are keen to do with our new agriculture policy that we're working on at the moment is to incentivize measures that improve soil husbandry and soil health so that we can aim to get better crop rotation, which can actually reduce the need for herbicides and potentially prevent the buildup of soil-borne pests and diseases. I think the other thing that we need to look at very closely is the potential for greater use of genetic technology to get us the natural resistance to certain pests and diseases. We do have new breeding techniques. These, again, are contentious for some. The EU is currently considering whether to treat these new breeding techniques as effectively GM techniques and to have them covered by the GM regulations. We oppose that because I think, frankly, it would slow down this approach, which actually provides many of the solutions for the future. But I think probably in recent years, our crop breeding and plant breeding programs have placed too much emphasis on yield, probably at the expense of considering other features like resistance. For instance, I had a letter from an apple farmer over the summer to complain about the fact that we had lost a particular pesticide that was very important for the control of woolly aphids. But you know, I can remember from my own time at agricultural college, and indeed on our own family farm, that as long ago as the 1950s, there was the Morling-Merton program of research, which actually came up with apple rootstocks that were resistant to woolly aphid, to the point that 20 years ago, woolly aphid wasn't much of a problem. And I guess the question is, why is it that after nearly 70 years, we haven't managed to take those genetic traits from MM106, which was the famous resistant to woolly aphid rootstock, and put it into M9 and M27, which are the rootstocks most commonly used today. Indeed, M9 is what around 90% of Europe's apple orchards are built on. It should not be, in my view, beyond the wit of man to get that gene, the gene and the trait that is in those resistant rootstocks into the commercial ones used today. Another area where I think we could be doing more is when it comes to natural predators. And again, as long ago, I'm sounding old, but as long ago as the time when I was in an agricultural college, there was a lot of excitement in the 90s about the potential for natural predators. In the soft fruit industry, we used one called Phytocelius, which targeted red spider mite, which is the main pest that you have on strawberries. We even had one called Amblyseus, which used to target a tarsonemid mite, which was a much rarer problem in the strawberry industry. And there were many others as well. And it was thought at the time that there would be great potential for this, to expand their use beyond just glasshouses and protected cropping to more field-scale deployment. But that's not really happened in the way that I would have expected it might have happened with 20 years of research behind it. So perhaps we need to look again at this area and indeed also other approaches such as biocides to see whether we can have that as a supplementary approach to the use of chemical pesticides. Last year I attended a committee hearing by the Lords where they were looking at genetically modified insects, which sounds incredibly scary. I don't think the Daily Mail were there because they probably have a field day reporting this idea of genetically modified insects. But actually what the committee were really looking at was an approach called the sterile insect technique, which again is not a new technique. It's been used since 1948 in some parts of the world. And the concept is that you release, particularly it's being used against mosquito and malaria at the moment, you release a large number of sterile male insects, which then mate or attempt to mate with female insects, leading to a crash in the population because they are sterile. There is no chance of the genes traveling into the population because by definition they're sterile and nothing comes of it, and these are repeatedly released to suppress the populations. Now today a British company called Oxitec is actually leading the way in a new generation of sterile insect techniques using genetic modification to adapt mosquitoes to make them sterile. So whereas in the past there was, I think radiation was used to make them sterile, there is a new approach. And again, this has been used in some other industries. It's been used, I think, on cotton farms. Could we be doing more to use the sterile insect technique on some of the insect pests that we have here in the UK? So I think there is a real opportunity to renew this approach of integrated pest management. And I think if integrated pest management is the prism through which we make all decisions, regulatory decisions by government, but also agronomic decisions on farm, then it is possible to see a future course where we can have good and improving crop protection, but recognising that chemical pesticides will always be part of our approach to dealing with those pests and diseases. So that is perhaps a longer-term vision, a longer-term strategy that I would like us to encourage looking forward. But I recognise as well that there are many short-term considerations. There is the issue of what happens when we leave the European Union with existing authorisations and product authorisations. Now, to ensure that there is a smooth transition, we've already made clear that in the first instance, the EU withdrawal bill, which is about to go through Parliament, will bring across the entire body of EU legislation that we have now and place it on a legitimate UK legal basis. And that will include all of the current authorisations for pesticides in the EU. And that gives us the greatest chance, in my view, of securing a free trade agreement, because we will start with a position of absolute equivalence when it comes to these issues. But then there's a consideration of what we do beyond our EU membership. And I've been quite interested in the approach taken by the so-called Quad countries. That's Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand, where they have joint working groups to discuss technical details. Technical experts on issues like pesticides come together to discuss the evidence and to try to reach a shared understanding of the evidence, and then each country legislates in accordance with that evidence through their own legislatures. I think this is an interesting model that I would like us to explore as a future model with the EU. It means that the EU can still benefit from British expertise that we have within CRD, for instance, where we're renowned as being probably the leading country in the EU for having technical expertise in this area. But it also means we've got the ability to ensure that their interpretation of the evidence before them is right. But finally, it gives us the freedom to legislate in accordance with the evidence, even if EU countries decided not to. Because we all know that in many areas, the decisions are not actually taken in accordance with the evidence, the scientific evidence put forward and agreed by people like EFSA. We've seen recent examples of that just with glyphosate. The final thing that I wanted to say is I also recognise that there are even more short-term issues, hot debates at the moment on issues such as neonicotinoids, where there's a discussion going through the European Commission at the moment, and where the UK is studying very closely some of the new evidence that's around the presence of neonicotinoid in soils and the dangers of it getting into the watercourses, and also, of course, the glyphosate debate, where the UK has taken a very clear position that we believe the evidence supports the continued authorisation of glyphosate. We've been consistent on that. We share the view of EFSA. This is probably one of the most studied pesticides in the history of mankind. It's been studied over and over again, and we do believe it is safe, and we therefore supported its authorisation, or its reauthorisation, and we are disappointed that the other European member states were unable to back it this time round, meaning that we still do not have a clear decision on this. So it is an interesting and exciting time to be in DEFRA. We're working on a new agriculture bill, and we're going to put research and development and innovation at the heart of our approach. We're likely to publish a white paper on future agriculture policy sometime early next year, with an agriculture bill being introduced later in this session, possibly next summer or early next autumn. There's a lot of work going on in DEFRA, but I'm very keen to be here today and to hear some of your thoughts about the future of crop protection. Thank you very much.
Minister, thank you very much indeed for that. Looking forward, I must admit, as a chairman, I find it gratifying that you haven't filled your time in with all sorts of stuff and left no time for questions. I say all sorts of stuff, that's a euphemism for waffle. Now, I'm sure that your vision of IPM, how can it be used, technology, right through from sterile insects through from rootstocks, etc., can that be used? That must have generated questions here. Comments, please. It is just as important for us to give the minister messages as it is for the minister to give us messages. Here is our opportunity to talk to the minister and tell him of our hopes, concerns, worries. Please, I open the floor to all of you.
No concerns.
Please, sir. Can you introduce yourselves and your background, please, as you ask your question?
So I'm Alan Bullion, a journalist from Agro. Can you expand a bit more on the research and development basis for Britain's science going forward on this, and how these innovations will be funded and collaboratively worked out with our neighbouring countries?
Well, we're looking at a number of different approaches. First of all, we've obviously already got the agri-tech strategy, which I think has been quite successful, and it's about trying to get applied science on farms, deployable on farms rather than staying in universities. I think we could be looking to extend that approach and do more in the sense of agri-tech funding of that sort. However, I'm also quite interested in whether we could do more, to nurture perhaps more near-market research and development, particularly around plant breeding. I think if we're serious about getting and encouraging the approach that I've talked about to using new breeding techniques as a way of getting resistance into crops, I think this is something that we ought to be looking as to how we could encourage it. And one thought that we've been floating is an idea of loosely calling it research and development syndicates, where groups of commercial farmers could come together, put some of their money into a research project, but also benefit from some match funding from government as well, to have really properly targeted research aimed at plant breeding programs so that you can get progress in these areas.
Sounds like the Link program that you stopped about 10 years ago.
Everything goes round in circles.
Okay, yes, Richard, thank you.
Minister, I wonder, you've been very clear on the UK government position on glyphosate. I wonder if you've reached a similar conclusion on the proposal to extend the ban on neonicotinoids to seed dressings that we use on wheat, barley and other cereals. Coming from the southwest as you do, Minister, I think you'll be aware of the immense implications from aphids carrying barley yellow dwarf virus coming in and infecting crops, which dressings like Deter have a huge part to play in actually controlling. And if we were to lose those, for many of us, it would mean we would probably have to spray crops up to three times, which I believe would be vastly more damaging than any dubious evidence on neonics being used on non-bee-friendly crops. So I think we'd really welcome a statement perhaps on your position on that. Thank you.
I know you would welcome it, but I'm going to have to be honest with you and say we haven't reached a position on it yet. There is, and I've seen some of the papers, so there is a body of evidence. There is some science to suggest that the repeated use of neonicotinoids in cereals is starting to lead to a build-up of its presence in some soils, and some evidence that that's getting into the watercourses. And that's obviously, if that is correct, that's a cause for concern and something we need to certainly consider. I very much understand that these are important chemicals used throughout farming, particularly on sectors as well like sugar beet, where there really aren't any viable alternatives. But coming back to what I said earlier, I think some of the issues we have here is because we have a dwindling arsenal of chemicals, we have fewer and fewer options. So coming back to your point, that we used to have a product called Afox, which is a highly selective herbicide aimed at aphids. For various reasons, that was lost. And I think that's sort of driven wider usage, perhaps, of neonicotinoids, that then itself, of course, starts to have an issue. And it comes back to my point that I think we have to, well, I recognise that there will always need to be an element of silo thinking and looking at an individual chemical in isolation to look at its potential impacts. You also, I think, have to step back and have a more holistic view and take into account whether you're going to drive behaviours and drive usage of other chemicals that might be storing up a particular problem. And it comes back to this approach that I was saying, of we should be aiming to retain a diversity of chemicals, but use them much more judiciously and selectively. And that's not easy to get the policy infrastructure in place to ensure that happens, but that, I believe, ought to be our approach. So sorry, that's quite a long way of repeating what I said in my speech without giving you the answer you wanted. but I can say that we're looking very closely at the evidence and considering all of the studies that have been put forward.
There's a gentleman at the back and then John Peck. Okay, John Peck first and then the gentleman at the back. The microphone's coming to you, John.
Thanks, Tony. John Peck from BASF. Our authorisation process currently relies very heavily on various EU institutions. Well, firstly, am I right in assuming that the point of exit will no longer be able to rely on those institutions? And if indeed I am correct, what's actually going on behind the scenes, if you're able to say so, to actually develop replacements and alternatives for those EU institutions?
And it very much depends on the, and this is where I said it's a challenging period in one way because there's uncertainty. And I know businesses say to me, we want certainty. But when we are in the process of a negotiation, having taken a big decision to leave the EU, you can't always give people the certainty you want, because by definition, there are certain things that the EU is not even discussing at the moment. Now, our response to that is that we have to be ready for all scenarios. So our preferred outcome is that we have a proper future partnership where we retain the ability to make our own laws and retain the ability to do things differently, but also where we have a comprehensive free trade agreement and where we work jointly on certain things. Now, I've set out in the context of pesticides, I'm interested in what the Quad countries do, and I could see a model where we would share technical expertise and work together to get a shared understanding of the evidence, but then have the ability to legislate through our own procedures. I think that would be a good model going forward. But in terms of your specific question, we are also having to prepare for the possibility that we will leave the European Union without an agreement under what's called WTO rules. There is a lot of contingency planning going in place to ensure that we have the necessary bodies and inspectorates set up to be able to take on all of the work that the EU currently does. When it comes to pesticides, I actually think that's more straightforward, having looked at it, than some people realise, because the Chemical Regulations Directorate within HSE already has a large amount of expertise in this area. We already, as well, have committees like the Expert Committee on Pesticides, which have got a body of knowledge in this area. We already authorise products. What we would be doing is authorising the active ingredients as well. So I don't think it's beyond the wit of man to stand up an ability for CRD to have a wider scope in terms of authorising active substances as well as products. I think we've got the expertise to do it already.
Okay, there was a gentleman at the back.
Hi there, Chris Hartfield from the National Farmers Union. At the risk of labouring the point on neonicotinoids, but a question from a slightly different angle. My big concern about the neonicotinoids issue is that the basis of the regulatory decision that the Commission is making in proposing to extend the ban is based on the bee guidance document, which, as we know, hasn't been agreed by member states, yet it's being used in anger against neonicotinoids. And there is work done by the industry that if it's used against other, or used to assess other pesticides, then all other insecticides would similarly fail, as neonicotinoids have. Many herbicides will fail, many fungicides will fail, and indeed many products used in organic agriculture will fail the bee guidance document. Now, my big concern is that if member states vote to extend the ban, they are in effect supporting the regulatory basis on which that proposal has been made. And I'd just like to ask the Minister if he has a view on that, that a vote to extend the ban on the neonicotinoids will be seen as an endorsement of the Bee guidance document?
That's not how I would see it. And I, you know, when I approach how these things, I'm not looking at it through the context of, you know, some Bee guidance document that might exist in the EU. For me, it's much more fundamental. It is about looking at the, you know, the actual data and the actual research on which this is based. Now, as I said, I have seen some documents that do suggest that there is a, you know, you get a build-up in certain soils. It varies depending on soil type, obviously, as these things do. Maybe the presence of it in the soils means that it's not in the watercourses instead. So these are complex areas, complex issues. And we also know that around the field boundaries, around the headland, you tend to get a build-up sometimes on the headlands. Now, again, the results are quite variable, and I suspect that's probably to do with people spinning around with the drill at one end of the field and some of the dressing coming loose from the drill. So there's lots of complicated issues here, but for me, it's not really about the Bee guidance document. It's much more about looking more fundamentally at the evidence that's being presented.
Okay. Yes, Peter. Can you just wait for the microphone, please, Peter? Behind you, on your left.
Peter Campbell from Syngenta. Of course, I have to say something about neonics as well. I mean, the evidence you're referring to, Minister, it comes from one particular paper that got a lot of attention in the last year or so. And what worries me about that paper is they report residues in the headlands which are higher than in actually the crop itself, which is hard to understand. So I think when we've discussed this paper in the past, we have to be very careful about taking its face value. There are real challenges with that paper. But I have a question, another question, which builds on the guidance document issue that was raised by the earlier question. When you repeal the regulations, of course, all the regulations come through, and those EFSA guidance documents will also come through. And what you said earlier was one of the reasons you're happy about Brexit is that some of losing all those products because of the regulation outcomes in Europe is declining the number of products that we have available to us. A large part of that is due to those very difficult guidance documents that are coming out, like the Bee guidance document. So when we trigger Brexit, are we still going to comply with those guidance documents from EFSA? And the related question is the sad aspect of us leaving the European Union is the sane and the rational voice of the UK in Europe will be lost. And therefore, those guidance documents, we're going to see more of them. So I appreciate hearing your views on that.
Yes, I mean, on your latter point, it's why I think a good model, as I said, would be something like the Quad model that US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand have, because that means that we would be able to bring a voice and expertise to those technical level discussions, but be free to actually then introduce regulations in accordance with that understanding of the evidence. And that doesn't always happen now. So I think it is the approach I've outlined is the way of solving this. I mean, there is obviously a wider challenge here that unless companies are able to market Europe-wide, they may not feel it's worth their while to market just in the UK. So we do, I think, still have an interest in making sure that there's a shared understanding of the evidence here, so that if we're going to have certain authorizations, we can have them across Europe. And I think you would agree with that. In terms of your first question, the withdrawal bill will bring across everything that is set out in EU regulations. And so that includes, by and large, the methodology, the particular the trigger points, the thresholds in the first instance. Those will come across, and those will be basically broadly the basis on which we would assess things. But any guidance that overlays that wouldn't come across. It would be open to us, of course, if we thought that was useful to follow that. But it's the regulations that would come across, including things like the trigger limits and the process for assessing things, rather than the actual guidance. So if it's not written in law, it won't be coming across in the withdrawal bill.
One at the back.
Thank you. Martin Griffiths from Bayer. Very interested to hear about your thoughts about the Quad discussions and the scientific discussions with other bodies. Do you believe that Europe should be doing that today? Because we have a lot of concentration of regulations coming from Europe, but I think Europe could also learn from the rest of the world. Do you think there's also an opportunity for Europe to dialogue more with those four countries?
There may well be, and I think, you know, obviously the other body that's interesting here is Codex, and one of the things that the UK will do on leaving the European Union is take its seat on Codex. We've actually managed to get a British chair on one of the key Codex committees recently, and it's something where we're going to really, really double our efforts, because actually, increasingly, a lot of the thinking in these areas around things like MRLs is of global significance, and you do want organisations like Codex through the UN to start to have a worldwide understanding of some of these things. And for many countries, Codex is the approach that they would follow. So we are, you know, looking at basically strengthening British presence through Codex and using that as a vehicle to help improve a shared understanding of these technical issues on a global level, so that that can help to open up trade around the world.
John.
Thank you. John Knight from HDB. I agree absolutely about moving along the IPM road further, faster. It is going to be a much more knowledge-intensive type of approach, and I was just wondering what sort of support was going to come through to ensure that there were, A, the researchers to undertake the work necessary, and B, to support the growers and the advisors in making those decisions going forward.
Well, as I said, so we've been clear that we're going to keep the budget that we currently spend on CAP dedicated to farming and the farmed environment. We've been clear that at the heart of that, there's going to be a kind of new agri-environment scheme. But that doesn't mean taking land out of production. That means, and we'll be very clear on this, we want to place soil health and good farm husbandry at the heart of that approach. So we will be incentivizing some of these things, particularly the sort of changes to farm husbandry, soil husbandry, and agronomic approaches through that, through those incentives. But we're also clear that we, as I said earlier, want to support research and development, particularly when it comes to genetic technology, particularly where better genetics might actually find some of the solutions to these problems. So there's a budget that we've got allocated there. We believe that it could be spent far more effectively than the way the Common Agricultural Policy single farm payment is currently spent.
Okay. Colin.
Colin Rasko, Chairman of BCPC. Minister, you mentioned, and I was very pleased to hear, your support for genetic technologies as a possible way forward. And of course, you'll be aware that despite the advantages, say, of Oxitec's mosquito technology, which originally was applauded as a potential alternative to chemicals, some of the, let's call them the green lobby, are now opposing it violently because it's genetic modification in broad terms. You'll obviously be aware that support for appropriate genetic technologies will, by you, will come up against the same sort of lobby, and it'll be branded as GM and all that's meant to be bad about, quotes, GM. So you'll, I'm sure, have a big fight on your hands. And my question is really, what support, given that scientists' voice are often poorly heard against the badly educated, in some case, populace, politicians, rogue lawyers, etc., etc., that you'll be up against. What support can we as a scientific-based community give that might be heard and might be useful to you, other than, unfortunately, repeating good science and not being listened to as a result?
Yes, I think, you know, I'm willing to have this debate because I think if you look at some of the green NGOs, and to be honest, it's not all of them. I do meet some of them who actually understand that improved genetics can have a big part in this. But the argument is that in the past, GM was used to grow crops that was resistant to Roundup so that you had even more use of pesticides. And that is something that a lot of them are bought into. And of course, that did happen in some cases in the US. But my view is we should not let that cloud our judgment, because the reality is if you want to have a future where you perhaps reduce the deployment of pesticides in some circumstances but still retain them, you actually have to have a sensible approach to crop protection. And crop protection is the solution to this, not the cause of the problem. And genetics, improved genetics, is the solution to it. And I do think that fundamentally there is a big difference between the sort of transgenesis that you get in GM crops and the sort of what we call new breeding techniques like cisgenics and gene editing, where you're really just taking a trait from the same species or the same genus and bringing it across to a commercial crop. And I think there's lots of exciting work going on, for instance, on the sort of the wild relatives work with sort of wild grasses. I mentioned the fruit industry earlier. We have these wonderful genetic collections like the National Fruit Collection at Brogdale with every variety of apple and pear that there's ever been. And I think that a lot of the solutions that we need for the future are probably buried away almost in the sort of scrap heap of these gene banks that we have. And we've just got to get better at trying to identify those and use them and bring them in as part of our arsenal. So I'm up for having this argument because I don't buy into that that position. And I think particularly there's a very clear difference between new breeding techniques and genetic modification, and that has to be recognised.
Thank you.
Time for one more question so that we can keep on to programme timing. Any more? We're all perfectly happy with the minister's position. Either that or we just don't understand it. But I think that could be an unfair cheap laugh on my part there. I think the minister has been extremely open with us. Okay. Minister, thank you very much indeed for your time. You've shown us a very pragmatic approach to this, a whole range of issues. As John Knight from the AHDB said, a lot of this, if we're going into IPM, is going to be much more knowledge and more management-based than we have been in the past. We, as an industry, are going to have to accept that changes are on the way. We're going to have to play our part in those changes. But thank you very much indeed for spending time to come down to see us today and set us off on a very good course. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay,
thank you.